she never wanted to be perceived as being the other just because she was a woman and foreign.
The phrase that I remember very clearly is that she didn't want to other herself. Being in the collection is not enough. You know, it's about, you know, how do narratives change, or do they change?
Hello and welcome to Sculpting Lives, a podcast with me, Jo Baring.
And me, Sarah Turner.
This is a podcast series in which we take the life and work of six remarkable women artists. In this episode, we're looking at the sculptor Kim Lim.
Kim Lim came to Britain from Singapore in the 1950s, and she is someone who is receiving a lot more attention recently, but I think it's fair to say has been somewhat left out of the histories of modern British art in the 20th century, and definitely the histories of sculpture. So we're going to be looking at the reasons for that and why such exclusions happen.
That's right. Obviously, this is a podcast about gender, but with Kim Lim, race also comes into play. She married the sculptor William Turnbull in 1960, and they had two sons, Alex and Johnny. So we started off our podcast with going to see Alex in his home in London to find out a little bit more about his memories of his mum.
So she came from sort of a good family, and I mean, I think it's a real testament to her will that as a Chinese girl from a good family in 1954, she managed to convince her parents to let her come to London to study art. I mean, I think this only happened because her brother was studying law here, following in my grandfather's, their father's footsteps. And so she, you know, came to London in 1954 to go to the Slade and St. Martin's. Around 57, 58, she was introduced to my dad by a ceramicist called Hammond Hattori. And, you know, obviously the rest is sort of, is sort of history. I think my grandparents were really not happy about that. Mm-hmm. That was not on their plans.
Did they think it was just like a kind of adventurous...
Well, I think they thought, we'll let her do that. And then they tried to get her to come back. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, she was very adamant. And I mean, I was thinking about it the other day, and she could have had this, you know, incredible cushy comfy life. So she was so far, you know, ahead of the curve. And I think it's a real testament to her sort of strength of will and single-mindedness that she managed to do that.
We've just heard from Alex about how his mum, Kim Lim, came over from Singapore, aged only 17. She enrolls in art school in London. She starts off at St. Martin's School of Art, where she does wood carving. And then later on in the 50s, she enrolls at the Slade, where she studies printmaking. So, Sarah, can you tell us a little bit more about what art school in London in the 50s must have been like?
Well, I think it must have been really exciting for her as well, coming over so young, enrolling in a big art school in London, which did have a lot of international students. But as an Asian woman, Kim Lim was one of only a small handful of artists from Asia who were studying at the Slade at that moment. Another person was Anwar Shemza, the artist from Pakistan. And so she would have felt, I think, different amongst her contemporaries. Art training was changing, but the Slade also did hang on to its traditional methods. It was very much emphasising learning from the body, the human body. William Coldstream's methods were very precise, very analytical. So you had this blend of tradition and also this student body who wanted change. So I think it would have been really exciting. And of course, it's a place to meet people, make connections, and start to establish your life and career as an artist.
Well, that's right. So at the end of that decade, in 1960, she marries her husband, William Turnbull, and together they start to build a life, both pursuing careers as artists. And we spoke to Alex again about his memories of being at home with a mother and a father who were both pursuing very singular practices as working sculptors from home. They both had studios in the home.
Yeah, definitely. So that sort of blending of life and art is very much there. And Alex talks about going into the garden and seeing his mum carving, and that being one of the kind of strongest memories of her and how she worked and kind of included her children into her life out of necessity, I think, out of you know, just the kind of requirements of balancing a busy career and, you know, bringing up your kids. So you have to get them involved in carving and helping you wash down the stone. So here he talks to us a bit more about those memories of his mum as a sculptor.
We also asked Alex about his experiences of growing up in a mixed race household in Britain in the 60s and 70s.
Bill really embraced the sort of our Chinese life, which is actually very not so typical for a Europe, I think, for a kind of guy from the 20s and 30s who it would have been easy to have had a very sort of Eurocentric view of things.
How did that express itself at home?
Well, I mean, it just we had Chinese names when we were kids. We were quite, which was fantastic for him, but terrible for us, because going to a comprehensive school in the 60s, being called Chuan, was about the worst thing that you could possibly imagine. So it's Twang, Twing, Twang, Twang. No, normally accompanied by that, which is funny now, but at the time really wasn't funny. So I think...
Did you choose to change your name?
Yeah, at around 9 or 10. I think I just said to him, I can't do this anymore.
How did your mum find that?
I think they were like, fine, sure. I think, you know, they, you know, we had English names and Chinese names. Like I said, I think it was an incredibly progressive thing for them to do. I think now people are sort of understanding that the, you know, her work, much like Bill's work, actually, which has sort of not been accepted in the mainstream of British art. You know, Bill wasn't, because he was a Scot. So, you know, he said even when he was in the Air Force, they'd call him Jock. Even though he was an officer fighting side by side in a life or death situation with these guys, they were still, oh, like, all right, Jock, you're not really one of the... So you realise that even within Great Britain, you know, between the English, the Irish, the Scottish and the Welsh, there's this real sort of racist aspect that goes very deep. So, you know, Bill as a Scot, and also because he was an internationalist, because, you know, in the 40s he'd met all these guys, when he came back to the UK and was part of the independent group, I think he wasn't, as Nick Sirota said, he wasn't judging himself against his contemporaries here. He was judging himself against Giacometti and Rothko and Newman and those people. Mm-hmm. And he didn't sort of see himself as a sort of British artist. And I think Kim, the same thing. You know, was she Singaporean? The Singaporeans were always going to me, oh, yeah, but she left Singapore. And I had to sort of explain to them, look, you know, she had to leave Singapore to do art, to pursue her passions, because she couldn't have done it here. And so it's only now that they're finally readopting her and have sort of, you know, done a big acquisition of work, and they're sort of now really getting behind promoting her. But then she was never accepted as a British artist, because as a Chinese woman, you know, she fell outside of all of the sort of, you know, I'm sure my mum never complained or talked negatively about things. So she never actually expressed to me about racism. I know how much racism I had growing up. One of my real memories of her is, you know, when I left home, was going back to Camden, and then there's a sort of side entrance and a wall, and I'd sort of jump up on the wall, because there was a back big sort of gate that they locked, and I'd kind of wander, I'd sort of tightwalk along the wall so I could look over the fence, because she was always out in the back garden. She'd be wrapped up in her boiler suit, you know, with her bandana and her face mask, and just sitting there, you know, just chiseling away, you know, rain or shine, you know, winter, you know, in the freezing cold. And with back, arm, you know, numbness issues with her, you know, so carving stone. And neither of my parents had any assistance, ever. Everything they made. My dad, those steel sculptures, my dad welded them himself. You know, all those stone sculptures are, you know, they're hewn out from blocks by people in the stone yards. But, you know, she carved them, most of them by hand.
Yeah.
So there was a real process. And she used to have this huge... Another interesting story, this huge printing press in her studio, probably 2-ton printing press, and she'd get Johnny and I to turn the wheels. So, you know, from when we were kids, we would be in her studio. Bill, I realised, Bill's practice, you know, I've been in his studio and found my skateboards in his studio. It's like, oh, so that's what that's why that metamorphic figure looks like that. But, you know, his process was very private. You know, and it was never around. People said, did you watch your dad work? It's like, never. But Kim, because of seeing her in the garden and because we'd be in the studio pulling her press, she'd give us brass copper plates and we'd do lectures, and then she'd let us, and they always come out backwards because she didn't realise that everything was going to come out in reverse, all the writings in reverse. But she would really allow us from quite a young age to sort of participate in that process.
Kim Lim passed away in 1997, aged only 61, so young. And I think we have to think about, you know, her early death as being maybe one factor in why she's not as well known as she should be.
I think that's absolutely right. We only need to look at the exhibition histories to see that that rings true. So she dies in 97. 2 years later, in 1999, there's a major retrospective at Camden Arts Centre. But then we have to wait until 2014 until she gets another show, which is at Roche Court at the New Arts Centre in Wiltshire.
Yeah, it's quite incredible, that time lag, isn't it? So we talked to Bianca Chu, who's one of the curators who's really led a revival, I think, in Kim Lim's reputation and knowledge about her through exhibitions.
That's right. So Bianca is deputy director at Sotheby's S2, which is the exhibition arm of the major auction house Sotheby's in London. So we got right down to it with Bianca. We asked her about Kim Lim's reputation and why she feels she's gone under the radar.
There's not like a really a straight answer for that, because she had an incredibly successful career during her lifetime. You know, she was recognized both by the sort of British art establishment. She had kind of one foot there in there. And she also had an incredibly kind of rich life in terms of family life, travel, you know, her own artistic kind of convictions. There, you know, there's not really a straight answer to that question. I mean, I would say that it's amazing how quickly, you know, with the passage of time, an artist can somehow be placed onto the periphery. You know, her last major show was in 1999 at the Camden Arts Centre. That's 20 years ago. There was an exhibition at New Roche Court in 2014, but outside of London, you know. And so as a result, you know, you have, you know, a variety of factors which can lead to, you know, what's the right word? It's not a displacement. It's not
forgetting.
Yeah, it's kind of forgetting, exactly. But obviously there are people who are keeping it alive. You know, so I think certainly being a female and being foreign at the time that she arrived in Britain in the 50s, also balancing out the fact that she was an artist, living with an already successful artist and having a family and a home, you know, I think there is something to be said about trying to grapple with all those different hats and, you know, maintaining a certain kind of truth that is, you are an artist and you are a mother and you are a wife. You know, so I think that you know, is a kind of big part of it. Also, you know, she also was very clear in her own writings that she didn't like this idea of othering either. She never wanted to be perceived as being the other just because she was a woman and foreign. She talks about this exact experience. So growing up in a society where the emphasis was on custom rather than culture, my exposure to art was limited. One could see classical Chinese scroll paintings, ceramics, and collections of ethnographic artifacts from Southeast Asia, but not much else. The little I knew of European art was from reproductions. So the first encounters with real sculptures and paintings, prints, and pots in the great museums in London and Europe were unforgettable, and thrilling and intoxicating and bewildering at the same time. Everything was consumed with equal enthusiasm. It took quite a while before I could digest this multicultural diet. I had to select and separate on the one side things that I admired and respected, and on the other side to recognize those objects, paintings, sculptures, whatever, no matter how insignificant, which triggered a response of affinity. I suppose one accumulates a kind of mental pinboard, such experiences which sometime later act as signposts, so that one can find one's bearing, so to speak, in the process of discovering one's identity. Being female and foreign was never a problem as a student. Later, I realized that there was a difference, but what was important in the end was what I did and not where I came from. Race and gender were givens I work from. Perhaps the work does reflect this, which is fine, but I did not want to make them an issue. The sense of not belonging felt a little isolating at times, but it had the compensating element of freedom, a certain feeling of detachment from which one could view both East and West. I sort of see it as like she's in her own orbit in a way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was really still, you know, very present, a present voice in the 70s. And, you know, in the 1978 Hayward Annual, she was one of five women on the all all-female committee, which was a response to the previous year's mostly all-male kind of cast of artists. She was the only female and non-white artist in the 1977 Hayward Annual, which Bill was included in, artists like Frank Auerbach, Kenneth Martin, John Latham, you know, artists that are we consider, you know, kind of on the vanguard or avant-garde in terms of British art of that period. So she was really kind of contextualized in that way, and she was the only woman, really. And so it's interesting to that, you know, you have on the one hand the sort of the actions of the time as well as her own personal kind of musings on this. And I think she was, I don't think it's that she was careful or diplomatic. I think that she genuinely lived in two worlds, you know, and allowed herself the ability to kind of navigate freely. And that's what she talks about, is this freedom. And I think that's why she came in the first place to England. I think it's interesting for most people who see her in the context of her husband, because I think they were equally influential on each other. I think the element of travel and sort of displacement and experience had a huge impact on her work. But I also think you're right. She had this truth to material, which is something that she consistently was concerned with in her practice. You know, so I think in terms of the evolution of the material, you start with something, I guess, that seems the most basic or foundational, which is wood. She experimented a little bit with plaster and wood, so pieces like abacus. There's two pieces, abacus one and two, or two parts. One is in the Singapore National Gallery, and the other we had in our exhibition, the sort of sister piece. And you know, a piece like that, which is, you know, recalling something that is so clearly a influence from her childhood, you know, a traditional Chinese method of calculation, but then looking simply at the forms involved in what an abacus is. I think during her student days, you got the sense that she was certainly experimenting as a result of being taught by people like Anthony Caro. So you had her experimentation with fiberglass, steel, bronze. And I mean, I think those were the main materials up until about, besides printmaking, of course, but up until about 1979, when she had her first kind of sort of major retrospective, and that was at the Roundhouse in London. And it was kind of a watershed moment for her, because she saw all of her work up until that point together in one room, but in a non-linear way. So she presented them without any chronology. And I think it was one of those moments where she realized that her main concerns, which are, I would say, are form, space, rhythm, and light, kind of come together and coalesce in this exhibition. And she said that it was this understanding of a synthesis between ordered static experience and organic dynamic forms. So I think that is the sort of dichotomy of her work in some ways. I think it's more nuanced than, let's say, two sides, but I think those are the main points that you kind of experience when you look at her sculpture. And so as a result, you get her experimenting with a different material, which is stone and marble, something that has, you know, a lot of mass, is dense, is hard, and to kind of to sort of manifest that with using like abstract notions of space and light and nature. So, I mean, if you ask me about Kim's sculpture, I think they are, like, sometimes you look at them and you think they could have existed already in nature. There's such a minimal kind of intervention with them, but yet at the same time, when you look at a stone piece, like, for example, like ginkgo, it's like a monolith of carving. You know, there's incredible supple waves, and, you know, it's as if water had been, you know, basically traveling through that stone for generations in order to get that incredibly simple ripple. You know, I think that's what makes her work really interesting as well. It's that she had no studio assistants. It was all her by herself chipping away, especially when it came to the stone and marble pieces. There was nothing but her and her conviction.
So Bianca's been very involved in that reinterpretation of Kim Lim, doing a small presentation in 2017 and then a year later in 2018 doing a larger show accompanied by a book. In the same year, in 2018, there's a show in the STPI Gallery in Singapore. And it's interesting, Sarah, isn't it, to think about how these exhibitions work to reassess, reinterpret an artist's reputation and legacy.
Well, in many ways, exhibitions are a public stage. They are sites of encounter where past histories meet the present, and you can also start to shape the future as well. So articles, reviews, the book all work together in tandem with the presentation of the work, so people can really see it again. And I think with Kim Lim's work, it just seemed incredibly fresh when people saw it at these exhibitions. And they started to make connections to other artists, and it just kind of triggered something off in the imagination and reaffirmed that this is a sculptor of great quality and international importance.
I think it's also about like people's perceptions of success as well. Like we are a commercial gallery space. We're affiliated with an auction house, which is maybe the most commercial kind of element in the art market. But that being said, you know, a lot of the program, it's only time that can tell what real success is, and that's recognition by institutions and curators, by collectors for the work, you know. And, you know, whilst we are obviously sold the show incredibly well, the response was positive in terms of the commercial aspect. What felt more rewarding was that, you know, there were institutions and collectors and the general feeling in the art world that this was the time for Kim Lim to be recognized. And so while we helped facilitate it partly, it wasn't solely because of us. It was because the timing and the work the cards all fell in the right place. So I think in that sense, it's timing as well. And I think that sort of ties into, in general, this sort of recognition of new narratives and, you know, positions of women in recent art history.
We heard there how Kim Lim has been excluded from certain narratives within the histories of art and British art in particular, but I think it's also important to point out that she excluded herself from some of those. In 1989, there was a major show at the Hayward Gallery in London called The Other Story, which focused on African and Asian artists in post-war Britain. She excluded herself from that. She refused to participate as she didn't want to be seen as other. Sarah, that's an area of research in which you've taken a huge interest, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm running a research project called London Asia with Hamad Nasser, who's a senior research fellow here at the Paul Mellon Centre. And we spoke to Hamad about his work as a curator, how he first encountered the work of Kim Lim, but also a recent show that he curated at Manchester Art Gallery called Speech Acts, which looks at the presence of African, Black, Asian, ethnic minority artists in national collections in the UK. So Hamad really has been working and thinking very critically and carefully about the histories of British art and how to expand the narrative of art history in Britain. So that's something we talked to him about in relation to Kim Lim's practice.
I can't sort of put my finger on it, but she's one of these figures who have loomed in the imagination for some time. She was at Slade alongside Anwar Jalal Shamza, who's an artist that I've done some research on and been interested in for some time. So she was always somebody I was interested in, but had not really come across a large body of work of. And then I recall seeing, I think, a couple of sculptures at the National Gallery in Singapore after it opened. And I was really sort of struck by just how she played with form, you know, something which was so simple, but managed to be, you know, quite complex in its simplicity.
And then you have included her work in exhibitions that you have curated.
So yes,
kind of ongoing conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, then it sort of started a little conversation, and as she's a figure who kept coming up. So one of my research projects while I was at Asiad Archive, in fact, for a conference that the Paul Mellon Center organized, was around the history of the other story and its afterlives. Mm-hmm. And while we're sort of working on digitizing the archives of Rashid Araim and the correspondence that was going on, I came across probably the politest letter of refusal that I've seen. And this was for Kim Lim. So she was one of the four artists who refused to be part of the other story. And what the phrase that I remember very clearly is that she didn't want to other herself. And I thought, okay, this is somebody who's really, you know, very interesting, thoughtful, has a wonderful practice, and I'd love to find out more. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And when I was sort of invited to curate the Speech Acts exhibition at Manchester Art Gallery as part of the Black Artists and Modernism project that Sonia Boyce was leading, one of the things that stood out for me was, as part of that exercise, Anjali Dalal Clayton, who is a postdoc fellow of the project, was building this database of work by artists of Asian and African heritage in public collections. And after Anish Kapoor, Kim Lim is the most collected artist
in British collections.
So there are more than 80 works by Kim Lim in the public collection. And when I saw that and said, okay, but this does not compute with the kind of her place, at least in the British art history I've read,
yeah,
or in the histories of sculpture or of practice that one comes across. And that was a real anomaly. So even though with Speech Acts, we were mostly borrowing work from four different collections, mm-hmm, in Brayston, Bradford and Manchester, and as luck would have it, they didn't have Kim Lim in their collection, I felt it was really important for the exhibition, for that relationship to be there, for her work to be in conversation with people like Shamsa and Bridget Riley and Paul Lotzi and Barbara Brown. So people who were operating in the visual sphere at that time, with sharing many of the same sort of formal concerns, and even some of the sort of the playful movement and malleability of the sculptural form.
I mean, that's a really interesting issue, because what you're saying is that presence in a collection does not necessarily equate to visibility within a narrative or within a history, because I'd say, you know, most of the conventional histories of modern British sculpture up to fairly recently have not included her. Yet there is a significant body of work. It's not like she's exactly invisible, because her works do exist in collections, on databases,
yeah,
such as Art UK. So it's kind of like, how then do you intervene in translating that from the presence in collections to an actual, you know, physical, serious presence within the histories of British art or the histories of British sculpture?
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of my sort of key learning points. So just thinking about that particular piece that I presented at the conference on this, you know, this idea of the other stories of the afterlives of the other story. In my first draft, I sort of concluded by saying, oh, yes, it's through entering the collection that you get to bust these art historical ghosts. And then, you know, sort of coming across this body of work, looking at things like when the Conceptual Art in Britain show, where, you know, people like Rashid Araim or David Madala or Lee Wan Cha are not in there, it sort of, you know, brought home to the fact that just being in the collection is not enough. You know, it's about, you know, how do narratives change, or do they change? In that particular case of Speech Acts, the real sort of the goal was to say, is can you use things that sit in sort of storage in the collection, but use them in ways that actually ask questions of the story that you're narrating yourself? So can the collection become a toolkit rather than a narrative that is simply repeated and reinforced through displays and publications and highlights and etc. So that really brought that home to me, and also just sort of revealed the scope of work that needs to be done, you know, which is both kind of overwhelming but also exciting, because this is not work that anybody can do on their own. Mm-hmm. It's about how do you invite people in to even just take a look at their own collections and see what new stories they can develop out of it.
And do you get the sense that the story is changing?
Very much so.
So we heard from Bianca and Hamad there about how important exhibitions are in restaging reputations and offering a chance to reassess an artist's life, career and legacy. It's a really complicated process involving many factors and many people, not just curators, museum directors and gallery spaces, but also the artist's family and their estates too.
That's absolutely right. So Kim Lim's sons, Alex and Johnny Turnbull, worked very close with Bianca and the rest of the team at Sotheby's S2. I know they've worked with the STPI Gallery in Singapore about their mother's reputation and putting on exhibitions there. They've also created a purpose-built studio called the Turnbull Studio, in which to showcase the work, prints, drawings of both their parents, so Kim Lim and William Turnbull. We spoke to Bianca and Alex about how important artist family is in terms of reputation.
I mean, I think now more than ever, as the contemporary art, in the last 50 to 100 years, let's say, the emergence of, you know, recognition of major artists means that their legacies and their practices have to be protected by those who knew them the best, or family, friends. There is a need to protect the perception of their work, how they should be, from basic things to how they should be installed, to maintained, conserved, but also the choices made as to the context that they are then put into after. For example, the fact that Kim chose not to be part of the 1989 exhibition that Rashida Rehn did called The Other Story, you know, it wasn't a rejection as so much as her, you know, basically saying, I'm not ready to be, I don't want to be othered. I don't want to be perceived in this context. And that means that, you know, it gives you a hint as to how they would want to be perceived down the line, I think. Alex and Johnny, I think for them, it's a deeply personal thing. And I think with any artist's estate where the custodians are family, particularly children, you know, there is this need to also, it's constantly a tension between protecting a legacy and letting go.
What an artist is and what an artist has to do and what an artist's studio has to do has changed. You know, historically, artists, families and estates, it's not always a good fit. Mm. And so I think, you know, we were very aware of the pitfalls. I convinced Johnny that we needed to have an external space to present the work and look after the work and start doing all of this. And we looked at a load of places, and this was the last one we looked at. And actually, it was a place called the Sculpture Factory, owned by a guy called John Crisfield, who's still here. So they used to make Paolozzi's and Alan Jones's. So the Alan Jones above the entrance was made in here. And when we came in, it was just chaos. It was just a metal workshop. Bandsaws. This bit was a huge opening in the floor where they could kind of crane stuff up downstairs. And I think that had obviously put everybody else off. But we were like, oh wow, this is perfect. The soul of the place is perfect. And so we just got it and, you know, did it up. It's very different from how it was. I think everyone in here was very happy to see the back of the metal workshop, because they used to cut sheet metal out in the courtyard and stuff. And then it's just been like a kind of private space that we've used for curators and, you know, a bit for collectors, but to give talks and stuff like that. And basically to keep their work alive and be able to sort of have works that people haven't seen. And we've learned to kind of curate their work here by laying it out and putting things on. It's like, oh, wow, yeah, those two things have never been together. Like all the flat reliefs of Beatles and the mobiles had never sort of, it's like, of course, they're all from the same period, but they'd never been presented together. So we just, we just built this and slowly evolved it as a space. And it's been a real godsend, really, because this is where their work is alive now, really. It's not, it's manifesting itself in these museum shows and stuff and the stuff that's happening now. But I think without this, it would certainly have taken a bit longer. Let's just say it like that. I don't know that it wouldn't have happened again. And, you know, maybe without our interference, somebody else would have jumped on it sooner. But I think the one thing that is definitely true is that you know, if I hadn't started doing this stuff with Bill when he was alive, it would have been much harder. And to have come to all of this and to now doing Mum's stuff, having done Bill's stuff, it's like we understand what it is, what it takes, what to do. I mean, we're swimming and stuff in here, literally.
So
I mean,
much,
it is, you know, two artists' lifetimes work. You know, it's like 110 years combined.
Yeah.
You know, non-stop creativity. So.
I'm from so far back, you know, yes. To have the work from the late 50s.
But also, I mean, we were lucky that both of them were so fastidious about the way they looked after their things. It's like, this is the same as it was in 1960 years ago. So it's not, it hasn't, you know, decayed, it hasn't sort of, you know, it's sort of, so everything is incredible, in very good condition, mostly. It's a big responsibility. But it's never been a burden, and actually it's an incredible opportunity. I mean, I'd never thought that I'd be doing this, but we've met incredible people through doing it. A lot of them are kind of people we knew a bit and had reacquainted ourselves with, or then there's the people like Bianca that we've made new relationships with. It's been an incredibly rewarding sort of thing to do, really. It's been really, you know, really, I'm really proud.
If you hadn't heard the name Kim Lim before this podcast, I can tell you that she's someone that you're going to be hearing a lot more of in the future. There are a number of really exciting exhibitions in the offing, but Art Secret, we're not allowed to tell you where they are yet.
But it will be exciting to see what happens as a result of those projects and how her career and legacy is even further reassessed. In my opinion, she is a phenomenal artist of international importance and really deserves to be better known. So we look forward to kind of seeing what the future holds.
That's right. And it's not about reasserting her into the narrative, is it? It's about breaking those narratives
apart.
It's
about disrupting it and messing things up.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
There are very few recordings of Kim speaking. So we actually asked Bianca to pick one of her quotes, one of her favourite quotes about Kim's practice and work, and read it aloud for us.
This is a slide presentation that she did. I think it was a talk she gave at Whitechapel Gallery, if I'm not mistaken. It will be evident from these slides that my concern in sculpture is not so much for volume, mass, and weight, but rather with form, space, rhythm, and light. I think of space as a physical substance, to be articulated, manipulated, to be trapped, squeezed by using the forms in a specific way. Using form to punctuate space, using space as intervals. Space as place, outside, inside, close to the ground, suspended, floating, corner spaces, floor, wall areas. It's very exciting pushing a medium or process to the edge, so long as one doesn't fall off the edge.
Thank you to Alex Turnbull, to Bianca Chu, and to Hamad Nasser for joining us on this podcast, and also to our sponsor, the Paul Mellon Centre for Studies in British Art.
You can check out our Instagram page at Sculpting Lives for more information and images of all the works that we've talked about in this podcast. Join us next time where we'll be looking at Phyllida Barlow.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye. This podcast was written and presented by Sarah Victoria Turner and Joe Baring, produced by Claire Lynch, with research assistance from Isabel Mooney.